since 1971.
Well, you know, I could Tina Turner guy, that's for sure. Okay, let's fade that out. We got a lot of calls here. Number's 354-WRIF. Interested in drugs, what part they play in your life, and what you think about them. We're going to take our first call.
The home of rock and roll throughout the 70s and into the 80s.
That's tonight's Riff Rarity on WRIF 101 FM from The Who. Sounding a little bit different there.
Detroit's only real rock and roll radio station in the decade of the 90s.
101 WRIF. Detroit. There's Allison Chains wrapping up your High Noon Riff All Request Hour today.
If it rocks, it's on the Riff in the early part of the 21st century.
Hey, Sunday was another big day at Michigan International Speedway. We spent the morning before the race in the Budweiser Acceleration Tent.
For nearly 50 years, we are, have been, and continue to be 101 WRIF. Here is Mike Staff and our special guest, Drew Lane.
Welcome to the podcast, The History of WRIF, in which we are having conversations and looking back on the people and the personalities that made the Riff for the last 50 years. I'm your host, Mike Staff. I had such a blast being on the Riff for 14 years from 1992 until 2006. And today I have the absolute pleasure to have a conversation with one of the most successful radio show hosts, not only in the history of the Riff, but also Detroit radio. The Drew and Mike Show dominated the airways for 22 years, and I'm super happy to be here with Drew Lane. Hey, Drew.
Hey, Mike. How you doing, man?
Doing great, and thanks for inviting me into your bitchin' podcast studio.
You're very welcome. Notice we have the WRIF microphones.
It sounds familiar.
What are these microphones, Mark?
I don't know. Let me look at it. RE27.
Exactly.
Are they Sennheisers?
I don't know.
This is for the geeks out there. Anyway, the idea was to sound
away
as much,
your secrets
as much like WRIF as possible, and I desperately want to get Sherry Powers over here to help us get that ballsy resonant sound.
Yeah, man.
And that was riffs always sounded so good to me.
Yeah.
On the dial.
Yep.
The first time I heard it, and it sort of lived up to all those preconceptions, because WRIF, the call letters were just so massive in my little head.
Right.
You know, living in Virginia and going to Virginia Tech and doing radio at a tiny little AM in Collinsville, Virginia, and an AM in Roanoke, Virginia. WRIF was this gigantic, monstrous thing, and that's why it's been fascinating listening to Karen Civelli and Arthur Penhallow and Steve Costan and JJ and George talking about their trek and how they got there. And mine is really different.
Well, yeah, it is. I guess you'd be one of the few meltdown there who weren't actually born and raised in Detroit.
Right.
So that's one of the themes from all those people.
And that was something that was very much held against me when I got here, because the first or second day on the air, Bob Talbert did a story about the graveyard of Detroit morning shows from out of town.
Oh, geez.
And it was, I mean, the list was incredibly long. And some of them were very good shows, too, that had failed here, including Pat and Wags.
Right.
On WRIF. So, and I remember about a year and a half in, after Zip had had some issues and he had exited WRIF, as the trades say.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was Mike and I and Trudy. And Bob Talbert had done another, I think it was a story about, it wasn't about our show, but it was just about how out-of-town shows, I think it was about he was talking about Howard Stern or something coming in, saying how out-of-town shows just didn't work. Mm. And someone highlighted it and put it up in the cafeteria at Riff. It was like, What?
Motivation, what, though,
what?
Huh?
And what the worst part was that it stayed up for a couple days. I was like, what is this? That was a rocky stretch of road there.
Yeah, but Bob Talbert came around.
Yeah, Bob Talbert did come around. He did.
He became a believer.
And I always believed that it local was so important. And Mike was from here.
Mm-hmm.
So we always had a huge local element in our show. And we were very involved in what was going on in Detroit. It was just a matter of, no, I was not physically born here, but we could figure it out. It took a while, but we did.
Yeah, man. Well, hey, we got a lot to cover. And let's just kind of go back to the beginning, Drew, because this part is one conversation we've never had. But when did you know you wanted to be in radio?
I listened to WLS and WCFL in Chicago growing up, and Larry Lujack, and Animal Stories, and then later on Steve Dahl on WDAI, and then what became The Loop, and then The Loop AM. And actually, by the time I was in college, they had Brandmeier, Kevin Matthews, Stephen Gary in the afternoon, the best radio lineup I've ever heard in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Fabulous radio, minute to minute, all day long. But honestly, I think listening to WLS and WCFL as a little kid, and also they used to have Howard Cosell at 8:25 every day, and I loved Howard. I just loved his voice and the way he expressed himself. And I don't know, there was something about that little box and all the listening to sports on the radio, too. You used to listen to Bulls games and Hawks games and, you know, Hawks coming left to right. And you kind of knew where in the stadium they were because the descriptions were so good. And same with the Bulls games and Cubs games and Sox games. And I think I love the painting pictures element of it. I hate to say that because it sounds so cliche, but I really did like that part of it, being seen.
Well, and it was the talk radio part. It wasn't like you wanted to go on and spin Zeppelin albums.
I think I would have if that is what I had to do. But when I started getting into radio at WVT, College Radio, Virginia Tech, and I did a sports talk show called Sportsline there, and I realized that, it's the morning shows and the talk show guys that have all the fun. I mean, playing record, your favorite records is great, and influencing people about music and talking about music, but it was really talk radio was where it was at. So that became a goal pretty quickly, was I got to get a morning show.
Yeah.
And so, first of all, that was where all the action was. And second of all, if you're going to make any money, and anyone who would advise someone about radio in the mid-70s or early 80s would say, oh, you can't make any money in radio.
Right, not even on a morning show back then.
In many cases, that was true, but because I was already getting really into it, I was reading trade magazines, and I was saying, the Grease Man signs 4 years, $400,000, which was a ton of money at that time. And Steve Dahl made a lot of money. And the guys that I knew of in Chicago made a lot of money on the radio. And so, Detroit was a market like that. Detroit was a big-ass radio market, and successful shows did make good money there. And so, unlike you guys who came through Specs Howard and saw, hey, logical transition, I live here, I should work on WJR, WRIF, or whatever.
Right.
To me, it was like, how do you get from this small, tiny market of Collinsville, Virginia, or Roanoke, Virginia, 1240 WRIV, how do you get from there to a place like Detroit? And I was sending out tapes all the time, and it would always be, we need someone with large market experience.
Right.
Well, how do you get large market experience unless you're in a large market? Right. And finally, after, honestly, over 200 demo tapes of my morning show, WROV, I got a job in Charlotte, which was a big, not huge, but a big market.
Respectable, big time.
Yeah, it was, I think, market 44 at the time. It's probably higher now. But that was a real game changer because somebody heard my tape, really liked it. And I had a lot of people that heard tapes and said, hey, I really like what you're doing. Keep doing it. But I don't have enough experience. And so I needed to get another station on my resume to get to the next step. And so Charlotte proved to be that. Actually, I was working in the afternoons there, but we were Charlotte's afternoon morning show. So we did a lot. It was a lot of fun. Actually, I liked Charlotte. Didn't last long, though, because WAAF in Boston was looking for someone to replace Bob Rivers. Bob and Zip were a big Boston morning show.
Okay.
Bob Rivers did all the parody songs, the Christmas parody songs, Walking Around Women's Underwear, The 12 Pains of Christmas. He and Zip wrote all those songs.
I did not know that. That's very interesting. So when did you meet up with Zip and start working with Zip?
Well, that's a great story because, I was in Charlotte, and that was a sign-on. It was a station. They had literally, I think they knocked the transmitter off and said, we're going to spend some money, figure out what the hole is, and then we're going to do some marketing, Voyager Communications. And they spent quite a bit of money, I think about $500,000 on boards and TV when we signed on with a format, which was kind of an oldies format. I think it was best of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and this was 86. And they found the hole so beautifully. I know our afternoon show was number one almost immediately. And it was like, wow, this is incredible. This is how it works in the big time.
Yeah.
And they were great marketers. The morning show was number three or four. I mean, right out of the box, it did so well. And it was like, a hot radio station when it's new. That was so exciting back in the day. Now it's just like, I don't know, the format changed, whatever, who cares?
Who was that afternoon show? Do you remember?
The afternoon show?
AAF, when they relaunched. Was it of any consequence?
Oh, you mean in Charlotte?
No. You said AAF when they relaunched.
No, this was in Charlotte at 96 FM.
Yeah.
They shut off the transmitter, relaunched, and then I went to AAF from Charlotte, and Bob and Zip were doing the morning show there, and the American Comedy Network had started, and Bob and Zip were doing a lot of parodies in the American Comedy Network. And those parodies, I had played some of them because we were an affiliate. So I was like, oh, my God, Bob and Zip. Whew. And Bob and Zip were a hot commodity at that time, and a lot of people wanted to hire them. And they had a deal at KZAP in Sacramento, which Sacramento was not a huge market, but pretty big. I think it was like 28, 29. And they were supposed to meet at the airport to sign a deal to go there. And it was like 2 years, no cut, $125,000. Like, wow, oh my God. And Zip didn't want to leave New England. And Zip didn't show up at the airport.
Oh, jeez. So Zip didn't show up? Wow.
That's my understanding.
Tension in the relationship.
Yeah. I think I've caught that from Bob and Zip both as being accurate. So Bob, very angered by this, decided, I'm going out on my own. And he was also, he was a very big commodity himself and a great self-promoter. He went to Baltimore to WIYY, had great success there, went to Seattle then to KISW, which is the station, the WRIF of Seattle.
Yep.
Had a long run there. And he's doing a podcast with Zip now.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No way.
And Ed Kelly from WJR. They're friends with Ed from the American Comedy Network, too, because Ed does voices like crazy. Ed's a great voice guy.
Well, and Ed did some work with Calvert on Riff.
Oh, yeah. Calvert, that was on Wheels, I think.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yep, you're right. It was on Wheels. Yep.
Yeah, that's an, that's another very interesting story, because that's really what got me to WRIF was Ken signed that deal to go to LLZ.
And that's what opened up the spot. But go back a little bit with Zip. How did you team up with Zip?
Well, Bob took that job at WIYY, so they were looking for a partner for Zip, and they needed a leader. They needed a driver, I think that was the term they used. And so Zip and I met. I went to Boston. I had barely been in Charlotte. I mean, not even a year, and we were doing so well. I mean, Charlotte was like, what? But, you know, I wanted to do rock and roll, and I wanted to move to a bigger market.
Yeah.
Boston was huge. Mm-hmm. Boston was number 8 or 9. And WBCN in Boston was a monster player.
The Riff of Boston.
Absolutely. And more artsy fartsy kind of station. They would play a lot of Bowie and mm-hmm. Elvis Costello and the kind of people that Riff maybe wouldn't play. Riff is more straight ahead.
Yeah.
But they were very cool, and they were very much very ingrained in the city in every way, shape, or form. And WIF was chasing WBCN, and that was tough because they would lock you out of anything.
Mm.
It was like, oh, it's a BCN promo, you know, can't broadcast from there, can't do this, can't give you tickets. You know, it was very tricky. But Bob and Zip had carved a place in the morning, and I took over for Bob. And that audience really embraced us, I think, because Zip was still there.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of in the same way Mike had been Mr. Stress and Bob Boner with Ken Calvert. And so Mike really helped me get over in Detroit. Zip did the same thing in Boston. And we were floating along there doing really nicely. And
did
then
you guys click like right away?
We did. Zip is immensely talented, did a lot of voices, was a great production guy. You know, you don't find that many great production people, but he was. He loved production, and they had a four-track. There was like, oh, my God, a four-track! You know, which I'm sure people are laughing about this, because if you've grown up with computers, you know, four-track.
Four, yeah. But,
yeah, it was great. It sounded great, and once you knew how to use the tracks, mm-hmm. which was a little tricky, because, you know, you could be listening to the playback or the record, and those are two different things, yeah. and you could mess up a lot of production that way.
And we're talking reel-to-reel tape.
Yeah, but those were thick reels.
Right, they sure were.
Not the little two-inch, you know, the little the two-tracks.
Yeah.
But Zip was great at production. Production, and they were doing stuff at WAAF that I was like, wow, you can do this on the radio? Because Zip had a character, Ordell Creighton, you know, who would who was an old New Englander. It's like, you know, how you cocksuckers doing? And the way Zip said it, you know, it was like cocksuckers, C-A-U-L-K, but everyone knew what it was. And the only chink in the armor there was Bob had gone to WIYY in Baltimore. And right after I started there, the Orioles opened the season with 5 straight losses.
Mm.
And Bob said, I'm going to stay in the air until the Orioles win a game. And they lost 21 straight games. 21. I think.
They were 0-21. I remember the cover of SI. Yeah.
But he lived up to it?
He did. He stayed on. I know he took naps and stuff, but
I hope so.
But he was everywhere. He was on Larry King at night.
Geez.
And it was like, oh, my God, we're just getting past this Bob and Zip thing. And now Bob is exploding all over the place. So it was one of those, if you can't beat him, join him. Zip and Bob were still friends. It was a little fractured, but we started having Bob on the show. Mm. You know, hey, Bob, how you doing? Oh, I'm tired 16 days. Oh, my God, I hope they win. So that was a little tricky, but we worked our way past it. And eventually people never forget a guy like Bob Rivers. And the first few days there, it's like, where's God's weather? I mean, every phone call, where's God's weather? Because Bob did this thing called God's Weather, which was God on the crapper, supposedly giving the forecast, but actually we talk about a lot of other things. And there's a big echo and, you know, huge voice of God. It was a very funny bit. And they did benchmarks where every day at 7:15, God's weather, as they said, New England. So, you know, we forged ahead. We moved forward and things were going along very nicely. And then New City Communications, which is a great company, great young company, started the American Comedy Network. They sold WAF to Zappos Communications, and the whole building was in an uproar. Mm-hmm. And there was a new consultant, and he was telling everyone they sucked. And, you know, and so everybody's like, oh my God, what's going to happen here? Are they changing formats? They can fire us all. So we just started putting tapes out, and Bob and Zip had been out there 2.5 years earlier. And so now it was Drew and Zip, but we had some recognition. And so we had plenty of people that were interested in, and we ended up landing in Phoenix at KMXX, which was, you know, when I got to Phoenix, the palm trees.
And, yeah, big difference.
Yeah, it feels like you're on vacation all the time. And I remember a lot of people said, how did you get from Detroit to Phoenix? Oh, my God. But Phoenix was a very tough radio market. Mm. There were 36 FM signals that were of significance. So if you went up 0.2 of a share in Phoenix, it was a big deal. If you went down 0.2, it was a big deal, too. So it was a strange market. And not so much of a home feel as Detroit. There's a lot of people from other places. There's just a weird
imports. Yeah,
it was a weird place to work, but it was a great move up. We weren't chasing WBCN anymore, which was an all day job.
Right.
But you know, carving out an audience in Phoenix was not easy either because it was and this is the problem when you're working your way up as opposed to just going to Specs Howard, you know, and interning at Riff and eventually getting on the air and getting full which is like, that's too easy. Nobody should be allowed to do that. Right. Look at what I had to do to get here. It was really a battle. We took over for a beautiful music station, which did like a 1.5 share. I think it was a 0.7 when we got there.
And they flipped formats.
They flipped formats to Zip and I in the morning. And it was, you know, naturally nothing but complaints and people were livid that, you know, there's no beautiful music station anymore. So we had to build from nothing to make something happen. But as you're moving, if you're trying to move around and move up, you always end up in a bad situation. Nobody goes, right. Hey, we're number one and we just need the new morning show guy.
Right.
Yeah. It doesn't happen.
We're not getting rid of the number one morning show.
No.
Yeah.
Except when Mike and I left.
Right. Bam. And we will get to that.
Oh, my.
Coming up.
The reason they called me was because they had heard my tape. And Lynn Woodison was still there. Mike was still there, Mr. Stress. TC was still there. And they had signed them up. They were like, nope, Calvert, you can go, but you're not taking these people. And they were beloved by the audience, all of them.
Yep.
So they really wanted a sports guy. Not a sports guy, but a morning guy, you know, a rock and roll guy who knew sports.
Yeah.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
This is the history of WRIF, the podcast.
Hey, is this Drew and Zipper?
Yep.
Morning, how are you?
Good, right. How you doing?
I got a Monday morning bitch.
Oh, okay. Stress, are you ready?
You betcha.
Legendary personalities from Detroit's iconic WRIF.
I want to see the show. I just think that's going to be a really unique way to see your music perform.
I think it'll be really good.
Trust me, I'm just as interested.
Here is Mike Staff and our special guest, Drew Lane.
So then you were in Phoenix for how long before you got the call to Riff?
Almost 3 years, but it wasn't.
You got to tell the whiteboard story.
Yeah. In Phoenix, that's a great analysis there, Mark. In Phoenix, you know, we're at a 0.7 and we're crawling our way up. They spent a lot of money too, like Voyager did in Charlotte. Easy Communications was a spender, a marketer, and they believed in morning shows and talent and promoting. They spent a lot of money, and I just remember we were struggling along, like 2 share, 2.2, 2.3, and it was really tough. And it was like, God, are we ever going to break through? And finally, I want to say it was our 6th or 7th book there. We did a 4 share, which in Phoenix is a monster share. I think KTAR, which is WJR of Phoenix, they had about a 6.5.
Wow.
or something like that. And they had a guy named Bill Haywood that had done mornings in Phoenix forever. And Google him, by the way. He and his wife committed suicide together, which is a really weird. Yeah, I know, in a hotel room. Really sad, weird story, but pretty interesting reading, too, if you're a true crime fan. Anyway.
Sidebar.
Yes. Anyway, we started to break through. And when that book hit, it was, you know, celebration, champagne, the home office. Alan Box, who owned all these stations, he came in from, let's see, it was Great Falls Church, Virginia, was where their home office was. And, you know, regional PDs and all this business. Everyone was there celebrating. And I was like, wow, this is great. It's got it made. It's all great, you know. And because I'd been thinking, what am I going to do with this house I bought here if this doesn't get a little better? Right. And all of a sudden it seemed like everything is great. And during this party, I noticed there was a big sheet hanging over a whiteboard. And I was like, what's under the sheet? You know, what's this a surprise? Is it, hey, congrats, Drew and Mike, you guys are the best, you know, or something like that. I mean, I had great fantasies about what was under that sheet. Well,
of grandeur.
Grandeur, for sure. When they pulled the sheet off, it said, there's just a six. It's like, six? Yeah, we got to get a six share now. Six share? How we just got to a four. This was incredible. What do you mean a six? And I was like, oh, my God, really? Because you just didn't pick up two shares that easily in Phoenix. And after the meeting, it was explained to me that, well, radio properties were very expensive at that time. In the mid-late 80s, I don't know if you remember this, but radio just went, whew, just, you know, people were paying insane amounts of money for properties. And they had overpaid for the station. And with all the expenses and the marketing and all that, they had to make it back. And they had to win in that market. And Easy was used to doing that. They had done it in many other places. But it wasn't easy in Phoenix. So anyway, the Gulf War hits. It was 91. And what happened when the Gulf War hit to radio was AM was the big winner.
Right.
People wanted information. And it was hard. And, you know, you do the best you can. I remember we got a phone number for a Pizza Hut in Saudi Arabia that we would call. And we would ask them to put an American service person on the phone. And they would. And then we would conference them and call somebody at home.
Nice.
So it was great. I mean,
That's good.
They were phenomenal bits. And I think I had one on my demo tape when I sent it to Riff. But anyway, so we went down, I think from a four share, we went down to like a 3-1 or a 3-2 during the Gulf War. And when the Gulf War ended, it was like, okay, here we go. Everything's okay. But then one Sunday, when I got back from vacation, I got that famous Sunday call. We need to meet at the station at 5:00 today. I was like, what? Sunday?
This is not good.
No. And I had heard rumors, too, and I just couldn't believe it. I didn't want to believe it. I loved my house. I loved Phoenix. I thought, this is, you know, I'm going to just ride off into the sunset here. But Bob Rivers had actually told Zip that he had heard of someone interviewing for our job. Mm. And I kind of blew it off. I said, nah, no way. I don't think I even asked them. So, you know, we heard this terrible rumor. I just couldn't process that. I didn't want to. The war was over. I thought everything was on the up and up. Anyway, we went in 5:00, and they told us that, you know, they had just done a big research thing in, what do they call them? Focus groups.
Yeah.
And, you know, that some of the perceptions were really off, you know, in terms of the station and what kind of perception we had. And it was one of those things like, don't fight City Hall. This is just over. And I think we even said, look, you don't need to explain it. We know what's going on. Bye.
Yep, fine.
And so we were fired. And I'd never been fired before. And, you know, you feel like such a loser. It's like, oh, my God, fired. None of my friends get fired from their jobs. What is this?
Yeah, but I have heard you're nobody in radio until you get fired.
You know, it's true. It is I think you get your spurs when you get fired.
Yep.
So we started furiously sending tapes around. People knew us from the last time, of course. And we got calls, and the trade magazine, Radio and Records, would come in every Friday, I think, because I had to order. I remember how expensive it was, too. I was like, oh, my God, I can't believe how expensive these trade magazines are. I don't have a job.
Right.
Trying to pay a mortgage. And the Phoenix market, real estate-wise, had just gone to shit. Mm. The Charlie Keating SNL thing, where they converted all these senior citizens to junk bonds.
Right.
And so a lot of them had lost their homes. They lost everything, and there were, I think it was 40,000 properties in the Phoenix area were in foreclosure at once.
Wow.
So my house, which was, I think it was $173,000 when I bought it.
Ooh. Hey. Wow.
I think it was appraised at 136 or something like that. And I was like, wait, but that's, if I sell it, I'll have to write the bank a check. That doesn't work. So I really needed a job. And Calvert had left Riff to go to WLZ. So the reason they called me was because they had heard my tape, and Lynn Woodison was still there. Mike was still there, Mr. Stress. TC was still there, and they had signed them up. They were like, nope, Calvert, you can go, but you're not taking these people. And they were beloved by the audience, all of them.
Yep.
So they really wanted a sports guy, not a sports guy, but a morning guy, you know, rock and roll guy who knew sports. And I played baseball in college. And I think there were a couple things in the demo tape that were sports related. We had done some parodies about the Phoenix Suns and some other things. So that just kind of clicked in with them. And I think in a way they were wrong. They didn't really need a sports guy, but they just thought they did because Ken, you know, had been doing
Pistons.
And was a sports guy. I mean, Ken loved sports. He knew sports. So, and he knew all the athletes too.
Right, that was
a big deal.
Yeah. So is it Jim Pemberton that was
Jim Pemberton?
Did he have the final call? Was he the one?
He and Bob Shute.
Oh yeah.
And they were both super good guys. You knew Jim, I bet, right?
Yeah, real good. He hired me too.
Yeah, Jim was a great guy, and they really liked us, and they liked the show. And first, I came in because they thought we need a replacement for Ken, and everything was going great until we went out to lunch with Lynn Woodison, and after lunch, I said, let me talk to Lynn for a little bit. I could tell they were kind of, what are you talking to Lynn about?
this is before he even had a show.
I did. I was not even offered the job yet.
Yeah.
And Lynn was not happy. She was angry that Ken had left. She was angry at their response. She was angry. She'd been on the air by herself for 3 months at that point. And she was very sour. And I'm not criticizing her for it. I'm just saying she just was. She was very unhappy about everything. And so Zip and I had also gone to San Jose to talk to a classic rock station there, KUFX. San Jose was a good market. It was also, you know, they got numbers in San Francisco. San Jose proper was also a good market. It was like the West Coast. And, you know, it was, again, it was like flying into Phoenix, except it was San Jose. And it's like California. And I love San Francisco. And so I was like, Lynn Woodison, very unhappy. San Jose, Zip and I both.
Yeah.
Although San Jose had two morning shows, Bob and Blazy and KSJO. About three people.
Lamont and Tonelli.
Lamont and Tonelli, yeah. Because Mr. Skin used to be on with Lamont and Tonelli all the time.
Yep.
Lamont and Tonelli were very good.
Good show.
Really good show. And Bob and Blazy were really good too. And I really felt like having listened to Chapin and McBean and JJ and the morning crew who were at LLZ, I thought, God, I think we would fit in Detroit. I think this would be a very different show from those shows, and I think we could do well. We were younger, too, than those shows. And I just thought, you know, in spite of the not being from Michigan thing, which wasn't really in my head that much at the time, I just thought, I think this makes more sense. But I don't know, Lynn seems really unhappy. I just don't know about this. And so Riff offered me the job. And offered me good money, too. And I thought about it, and my heart just said, I'd rather work with Zip in San Jose. And so I told Jim Pemberton, and Jim immediately goes, what did you and Lynn talk about?
What happened?
What did Lynn say? It's Lynn, isn't it?
That's so fun.
So Jim starts explaining that, Lynn's had to go through this, and, you know, she's been on her own, and she's really unhappy right now, but we think that this would solve everything. And so he says, hey, I got an idea. Let me call you back. And she calls me back. He says, you know what? Why don't we bring Zip in, too? Why don't you fly in with Zip, and we'll talk to both of you? So Zip and I flew in. And Zip was Zip's extremely likable. It just went great. The interview was great. It was like a show. And so I was like, all right, here's what we'll do. We'll hire both you guys. And we had somebody representing us, and she worked out something out. It was great. And I was like, bam, here we go. November 15th, 1991.
Didn't Arthur take you guys out?
Arthur took us, yeah. Arthur, which didn't happen when I came in alone, but when we came in together, at that point, it was like, we got to nail this thing down. And so they said, why don't you meet Arthur Penhollow?
Take him to Trump's with Arthur.
I was just going
to
say, Mike, guess where they went?
Arthur took us to Trump's.
Of course. That was not hard to guess.
And, you know, the incredible thing about it was not only that Arthur was so huge. He was, you know, everyone knew Arthur.
Yep.
And Arthur had this history at Riff. I mean, he'd already been on Riff like 20 years at that time. And you know, he was a monster in the marketplace. And baby, you know, and you heard that on promos and everywhere on WRIF. And I mean, the station sounded fantastic listening to it when, you know, when your show wasn't on the air, you always knew that. And it just,
baby.
Nice.
But the funny thing was when we got into Trump was that everyone knows Art. How does everyone here, every dancer knows Art, every waitress knows Art, everyone knows Art? And it was like, well, what is this?
He must be here a lot.
It reminded me of a scene in,
Goodfellas.
What's the, Dustin Hoffman, Mrs. Robinson, The Graduate, when he starts renting rooms with Mrs. Robinson and he uses the name Gladstone. And I think he was there with Mrs. Robinson's daughter and everyone's going, hey, Mr. Gladstone, how you doing? You know, and he's like, I don't know why they must be confusing me with somebody else. But with Art, it was not, there was no confusion about it. Everyone knew Art. So yeah, we had a great time and we flew home and we worked the thing out and it was great. And we got here a week early and the idea was we're going to come in, spend some time with Lynn, and then we're going to drive around the market and sort of get a feel for where the commute was and how much time it took to be in the commute and where the traffic, you know, was really bad. And we were talking to Mike and we got along famously with Mike. In fact, Mike was the first person other than Jim and Bob that I met. I think they said, well, Lynn's not too happy. Why don't we have him meet Mike? And so we met Mike at the Ritz in Roseville.
Uh-huh.
And Mike was just, his laugh was the first thing you could not miss. And
the first thing you noticed about him?
And we made each other laugh and we just got along famously. And it was like, oh man, Mike's going to be great. And we just got to figure this thing out with Lynn. And so
that's the only one I have of you guys laughing.
The day before we were supposed to start, the show ends. Lynn says goodbye. And then she says goodbye to us. And about 20 minutes later, Jim Pemberton walks in. He says, Lynn just quit.
Oh,
what?
This is great. I'm surprised.
Yeah. And we were really sort of like, oh, boy. Maybe we shouldn't start tomorrow. How about it? No, we're going to start tomorrow. We're going to get this thing going. Everybody wanted to get this thing going because they lost a lot of momentum since Ken had left. And so,
well, and the show you did, it was indicated to the listeners that Lynn was going to be a part of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, weird.
Absolutely. And that stuff had just come out. You know, we've hired the show from Phoenix, Drew and Zip. Lynn Woodison will be a big part of the show, blah, blah, blah. Well, she had just had it and she quit. And, you know, in a way, I'm sorry she did because I think it would have worked out fine. I think she would have been happy. I think it would have been a great show. She had such a great voice and she was smart. She knew what she was talking about. And she knew Detroit and on and on and on. But as it happened, we started, as it were, with Mike and TC and Fred McLeod was doing sports. That was a big show. I mean, back then you would have 8 or 9 people working in a morning show.
Now, Mike, he wasn't full time though.
No.
He? Yeah.
Yes, he was. He was. They had hired him full time. They had more or less doubled his pay at the power company.
Oh, at the power company.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Where he had broken so many phones there doing Mr. Stress. He would go from, phone to phone, from cubicle to cubicle. And basically when Mr. Stress hung up, you know, the whole thing about the phone hanging up, he had broken like 6 phones there, and people were like, what's going on with the phones here? And these people, of course, were so excited he was on Riff that, you know, the people didn't really care. They just go, hey, my phone doesn't work,
right.
You know. Anyway, they doubled his pay, so he quit. He quit the, you know, the main gig.
That's a hell of traffic.
Did a full-time Mr. Stress every morning at 7:50. I think that's a fart he's laughing about there, by the way.
Of course it is.
It's funny that you can decipher that, Drew.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's a fart laugh.
I pretty much, I almost remember the fart, to be honest, which is incredible.
Coming up.
We just kept playing less and less music until we were playing literally like a song or two an hour.
Hmm.
And in the fall or in the spring of 94, the book blew up. We went from, I don't know what place we were, but we went from, you know, maybe 6th or 7th, 18 to 34, which is the demo we should have been at least 2nd or 3rd in, to number 1.
Nice.
And we were a firm number 1. I mean, it was like, boom! And 25 to 54, we were close to the top. And it was really almost like, wow, is that a total fluke or what?
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music.
Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
This is the history of WRIF, the podcast.
Mark's queued up this guy who, he had a lot of prostitution in his neighborhood, so he literally started running around with a video camera.
Yeah, precisely, and he films it and then turns the film into the cops and gets them busted.
Legendary personalities from Detroit's iconic WRIF.
There's a guy completely naked on top of this chick in the passenger seat. In broad daylight.
He just swung open the driver's door.
What are you doing?
I'm making love, my girl.
I'm making love?
Yeah.
What are you doing around his dick?
In my pants.
What are you doing? Took his pants.
Yeah. In my pants.
What are you doing with the hooker?
I'm not doing no hooker.
Nice English.
She's my girlfriend.
No, she's not. You know how many times I followed her?
Huh?
You know how many times I followed her?
Here is Mike Staff and our special guest, Drew Lane.
Everything was great with Mike, and we were rolling along, and then Zip started sort of hit a wall with some personal problems, girlfriend, and so on and so forth. Anyway, they more or less said, look, if you guys don't get your shit together, we're going to have to let Zip go, because I was performing. I mean, of course I was performing well. I thought I was performing pretty well. Zip was not on his game. Mike was sort of really growing into something bigger, and then I think about 2 months later, I said, we got to let Zip go. And then it was, we got to let Fred go.
Mm.
And it was, oh boy, what's going on here? And then Mike was going to be Mike. And that was, you know, that sounds really easy, but it's not.
Right.
Because he'd always been a character voice. Mm. But when he came out of character and became Mike, it was a little weird at first, almost like, what is my voice? You know, and you know, people like to push their voices on radio. And the whole thing was kind of strange. But because it was a morning show, I think he became Mike relatively quickly.
How long do you think it took to get his balance?
I think it took a year.
Okay.
But there were always moments where I think he would forget we were on the radio, because he was not a traditional radio guy. He hadn't grown up in radio. He didn't go to Specs. He wasn't a part-timer, then a full-timer. He didn't do a 10-to-2 shift. He just went right to the morning show.
And he knew no rules. He didn't know
radio
rules.
And that was a real advantage for him, you know, it was beg forgiveness rather than ask permission with him.
Right.
And there was a lot of begging forgiveness. But it was slow going, because we were just really, the whole show had to find its legs. And it was, I really felt it was coming around. I'm like, I think this is going to be good. I think it's working. And the problem was, because of the ratings and the time and the whole corporate scenario, you know, they wanted you to play 7 or 8 records an hour. Mm-hmm. Because Jim and George were playing 5 or 6, and Chapin and McBean were playing 5 or 6, I think, and they just felt like, I don't know, the show has its legs. Let's play music. We can't lose playing music. But you can lose playing music.
Well, you can lose momentum, that's for sure. That's what happened to you guys, isn't it?
Definitely. And we were losing playing music, and the things we were doing, I thought they were working and they were coming along, but it was just going to take longer. And the thing that we knew at Riff, though, that I don't know if anybody's told you this, because I've listened to Calvert and I've listened to Steve and I've listened to Jim and George, and you know, a lot of people reveal a lot of things, but did Ken reveal that, and I'm sure he knows this, when he went to Wheels, he was on in the afternoon, and Jim and George were on in the morning. Well, part of Ken's deal at Riff was that if he got a deal somewhere else, they had the chance to match it. So he got Mike Novak negotiated him a great deal at LLZ. It was a lot of money. And they had to be presented the chance to match. And so they knew from the contract that Ken was going to do afternoons for 18 months and he was going to move to mornings. So, of course, when it didn't work out with Ken, they immediately got word to Jim and George, you're out in 18 months, guys.
Oh.
Yeah. I know. Radio was so bloody then. It really was.
It still is.
So there was a lot of messiness there, too. We knew Ken was coming to the mornings. And I don't know that any of the stations were doing that well. I think Chad McBean and CSX were probably doing the best of the three. Wheels was second. We were a distant third. Well, then Greater Media sold Riff.
Great American. Yep.
Yeah, Great American sold Riff to Greater Media. And while that whole thing, you know, there's a lot of corporate stuff and FCC stuff, and everything was in limbo. Mm-hmm. Everything was in limbo. This is about 2 months before our contracts were up.
At 95.
94, okay. I believe. Might have been late 93 when it actually was announced, and it took a good year. So while this was going on, it was like, all of a sudden, there were no rules. Nobody really was – everybody was watching their own ass. Mm-hmm. And we just started kind of loosening things up and let's knock a couple records off this hour and let's interview this guy or let's make this call or let's take calls or let's do this or let's do a longer Mr. Stress or whatever it might be. And eventually, it got to the point where we're playing like three or four records an hour.
Now, Greg Osham was PD.
Greg Osham was PD then, yeah. And Greg Osham, to his credit, was very supportive. He thought that – this is what we should be doing, that, you know, you got to bust this thing open. And I think he knew that, you know, we were in limbo, too. So he didn't have to answer anybody, really. Tom Bender was down the street, and Tom Bender would come over maybe once a week. But I remember at the time, it was like, what's going on, Tom? Has anybody talked to Tom Bender? We had lunch with Art. And it was like, the only thing we knew is that he had talked with Art. So we knew Art was safe.
Right, right.
But nothing else. Everything else is sort of up in the air. And Tom, is, as nice a guy as Tom is, I just think he was in a position where he couldn't really make any commitments. So we just... we just kept playing less and less music until we were playing literally like a song or two an hour. Hmm. And in the fall or in the spring of 94, the book blew up. We went from, I don't know what place we were, but we went from, you know, maybe sixth or seventh, 18 to 34, which is the demo we should have been at least second or third in, to number one.
Nice.
And we were a firm number one. I mean, it was like, boom! And 25 to 54, we were close to the top, and it was... it was really almost like, wow, is that a total fluke or what? But honestly, it was one of those things. It was all coming together. And so when the book came out, I was like, man, keep it up, man. This is great. This is great. But Riff was still, you know, in limbo. We won another couple of books before the deal was closed. By the time the deal was closed, we were firmly entrenched, number one, 18 to 34, 25 to 54. And I know before that happened, the plan was that Riff was going to be the music morning show and Jim and George are going to be the entertainment morning show. You know, one of those things where, you know, you're controlling all these things at once and you're pulling all these strings. And that, of course, changed.
Right.
Because we had blown up and we also were without a contract. So we were in a great position. Everything was just, everything was coming up Drew and Mike. Right. What can I say? So, yeah, we signed a new deal and then it was whoosh, off and running. I mean, really, for the next 22 years, not exactly. I mean, there are always bumps in the road, sure. But it was pretty smooth sailing, you know, in terms of the audience. And
well, they brought Doug Podell in, and Doug was like, he was the best guy for the job, hands down.
Doug had Stern.
Right.
In Cleveland.
And he understood this talk show, morning show on a rock station.
Oh, yeah. He absolutely knew that if you had the local show that was talking, you had so much equity over the morning shows that were playing music. Mm-hmm. And that's true to this day. Look sure at Dave and Chuck.
Yeah.
I mean, they're still, aren't they number one by miles over the next guys?
Well, because they have something different and you can play a record.
And it, you know, it helped, of course, that the show before them had pretty good ratings too, I think. So, you know, those guys waltzed into a pretty good spot. I mean, maybe they made their mark by now. I don't know. No, I mean, they've been at Riff. They were doing well at 89X, which that can't be easy. I mean, they had to pay dues too.
Right.
But, you know, since they've been at Riff, that's 2013, 7 years. I mean, they're still way ahead of the pack. So,
you know, ratings are one way to kind of see that, you know, your listener base is growing and everything. But there's also this feeling on the street where you go out and you start to get the feeling that this is catching on and people are listening and they're fans now, right?
Yes.
When did you first get that glimpse away from the ratings books, just out and about?
Well, I think we were doing Lions games. Every home Lions game, we would do a remote, which, you know, looking back on it, I was like, how did I do that? Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. You're up every morning during the week, and then you're getting up early on Sunday and going after the Silverdome. And believe me, Mike was not happy about it. But we went out there, and that, too, became a real loosey-goosey thing where we really didn't play much music. Mm-hmm. We were just out in the cold with, you know, the Hangmen, this tailgating group who were drinking their asses off and having a ball. And it was loud and it was rowdy. And, you know, one week, these guys showed up with a hot tub. It was probably 10 degrees out and they had a hot tub. It was like three guys. And so we started ragging. I'm like, what is this, three guys in a hot tub? Right. What's going on? And this is the feeling you get when things are really working. It's like everyone is listening in the whole town. It's amazing. Next thing you know, this truck pulls up probably 20 minutes later, and it's the, I think it was the Trump's truck. It was like a little bus, you know, like a little travel bus or whatever. And it was either Trump's or one of the big titty bars. And out come 20 gorgeous women. And the next thing you know, like five of them are in the hot tub, a couple topless, a couple making out. You know, it was like, oh, my God. And I'm telling you, the whole side of the Silverdome had come over and people were standing on cars to watch and just complete insanity. And, of course, the police were there eventually and the Silverdome security. And from that moment on, there was Silverdome security watching our party every single week.
Now, didn't you go into the game and they called your name over the PA?
Yeah, they. What happened was, God, and I can't even remember what
sign
started this. Yeah, we had told people to put Drew Blows on a sign.
Yeah.
Oh, so it wasn't the same incident. It wasn't a hot tub.
No, it wasn't the same incident.
Okay.
It's a totally different thing.
That was from one of the tailgates.
Yeah, that was where it started. Was
Drew Blows!
I think I was sick for Sunday or Monday night football.
That's right.
And I missed the Tampa Bay game, yeah. And Doug went, and so Doug got the crowd chanting Drew Blows, and that was where that whole thing started, and boy, did that stick, I mean, to this day.
Oh, yeah, right. It did, never.
And it's funny when somebody's visiting, you know, an old friend or something, and somebody goes, hey, Drew Blows, and why do people say that? That doesn't sound very nice. No, it's affection, trust me. But
I have this big memory of when you guys were just lifting off, and the Wings were lifting off too. I mean, they were so close. 95, they get to the finals. They don't win. 96, they don't even get to the finals. And 97, they hit it big. And it was all about the Red Wings, and you guys had so much Red Wings on. And then
Mickey Redmond, too. Mickey was so beloved by our audience. I mean, they used to test this stuff. They go, oh my God, Mickey Redmond tests through the roof.
Right.
It was so popular.
Do you remember that the parade after the 97 Stanley Cup where we were up in a cherry picker?
Absolutely.
At Hart Plaza? That was one of the best times of my life, but I remember they had to be 30,000 people just around the cherry picker. There's a million people downtown, and everyone yelling, Drew Blow! Holy crap!
And yelling, bitch. And we were like a spectacle amongst ourselves, which was, I mean, you just couldn't be, you can't buy that.
No.
But the Silverdome thing, I think it had to do with us getting in trouble there, and we just asked people to put, I think we asked them to put Drew and Mike on a sign, and we picked the best sign to win a prize or something. Mm. So anyway, there were tons of signs, and we asked people to put them up at the end of the third quarter, and they all did it once, and almost all of them said Drew Blows. And so the cameras, they're like, get the camera off that sign, or, you know, because it said Blows, which is like, what, really?
Right.
And so I was sitting in the end zone with some people, and literally somebody in security came and plucked me out of my seat, and they're like, get out of here! Yeah.
Amazing.
And that was really weird, because like, wow, really? And I had a feeling it wasn't going to be popular, but I didn't realize what had happened with the camera crew and all that. Like, they couldn't put a camera on those signs, so there was an incident, and we were booted out of the Silverdome. And, you know, it reminded me, I was thinking about this the other day, because I knew we were going to talk. And it reminded me of all the things we were kind of kicked out of, which seemed like, you know, for two guys who are living relatively, you know, clean lives, right. We did get booted out of a lot of stuff, like the auto show one year.
For what?
Somebody asked Mike to yell bitch, and Mike's like, bitch, really loud. And this model, auto show model, went crazy thinking he was yelling at her. And it was like, oh, if the shoe fits, wear it.
Right, totally.
Which I think is what Mike said. And they were like, you know, how dare you? How could you say that about her? And it's like, no, you don't understand it. And it's like, you know, these are the three people who've never heard of the show, never listened to the show. Right. You know, they just work at Jolo's Arena, or no, we were Kobo.
Kobo. Yeah.
And so, boom, out of the auto show we were, and that was a big mess, and they had to clean that up, and, you know, because other people had to broadcast from there, and there was a lot of money at stake, and so on and so forth, and we got kicked out of a Red Wings game, too. No, we got kicked out of the Red Wings Stanley Cup celebration in Jolo's Arena, but that was over something CSX did. That was not us. They were just trying to get back at CSX. They just wanted us to go back
station,
to Tom Bender and say, hey, we're kicked out of the Red Wings celebration. And it was really very unceremonious, and I wasn't really embarrassed, but, you know, it just seemed like kind of a big deal. And what they had done is, God, this is so stupid now. Second City had opened up. And Jim and George had like a night there, Jim and George night, where they emceed, and they brought Figer out because Figer and Jack Kevorkian was going on at that time. Mm-hmm. And this is a total surprise to Second City. And you'd think Second City would maybe see the humor in that, right. Second City, but they didn't. And they were really upset about it. And that was what it was about, as far as I was told.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Would have thought.
And we should have been kicked out of the Royal Oak Music Theater, too, because Mike flew his chopper in there. Mike flew his chopper in there. There were like 2,500 people in there. Was that a Red Wings game?
Yeah, I want to say it was 98. That might have been the 98 finals, okay. I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Or and I think we had 97, 98.
I think we had some Rock Girl finalists, and there might have been some shirt for shirt going on. Yeah, it was all wild and fun and woolly. And Mike had his chopper, and people, and Mike had been talking, I'm going to fly my chopper in the Royal Music. And he'd been saying that for weeks, and people were really kind of excited about it. And he starts flying this thing, and you know, those blades are like, holy shit.
It's not a drone type. You know, that you see everywhere now. It was a full on, I think it was 4.5 feet long blades. I mean, that thing could have taken somebody's arm off.
Big copter for an indoor facility.
Oh, it was big. And it was.
Just remember the Silver Dome, he wanted to fly it at the Silver Dome, and they said, no, you're not flying it.
For insurance reasons. What?
We're worried about the turf. Remember that?
Yeah.
Well, the State Theater makes sense if the Silver Dome says no.
Oh, God, yeah, right.
I think the State Theater insurance people ought to talk to the Silver Dome's insurance people and maybe get that straightened out, because that chopper should not have been flying in the Royal Oak Music Theater.
Did he have permission, though, or did he just do it?
Well, I don't think they really knew we were going to do that.
Yeah, or the size of it, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't know, but that thing, you know, that thing was not easy to hover, and Mike was hovering it really well, but there were some close calls. It was like, you know, creeping down to people, and I think people were sort of like, oh, Mike knows what he's doing. Hey, look at the chopper! And he did a great job. I mean, I was amazed after. I was like, wow, you really... You know, and even Mike, he was like, oh, my God, I don't know if we should have done that. But in the end, it all went fine. And, of course, the chopper incident in the show was, in my opinion, one of the great moments in show history.
Here, Mike, are you ready?
I'm not ready, Drew, but here we go. Here's a big double thumbs up, which is what happened to the guy that emailed us, gave two thumbs up to 50 people after bragging about his helicopter. It went straight up and then right into the ground. And the guy was all bummed out, refused to talk about it ever again.
Oh, yeah.
Here's my two thumbs up. All right. Here we go.
3 weeks. It does look fragile, I have to say. If it... Oh, boy. And it's off the ground! I feel like it's a spruce goose. Whoa. It's like a bee's coming at me. Does anyone have the feeling that there's nobody has any clue where that thing is going? Wait. Oh! It's about 2 inches from the ground. He's hovering. Mike is actually hovering. It's awfully close to the building. Oh! It's about 6 feet off the ground, 8 feet off the ground. Headed towards the speaker. Headed towards one of our backyard greens here.
Oh, God.
Boy, I tell you, this is a high wire act if I've ever seen one. Oh, the rotors! The rotor hit! The rotor hit one of the stands for our tent here, and you can see it coming.
I got to admit, Drew, your play-by-play is every bit as good as the Hindenburg's.
I do. I feel it belongs in some Hall of Fame. I just love Mike. Whoa. He's really nervous. But yeah, that was, what a classic. That was fun. And we had a crowd there for some reason. Trying to get tickets for something? I don't know.
Just to watch him fly the chopper. Why not?
Oh, maybe that. Yeah. Right. What more do you need a crowd for?
Right.
Yeah,
everyone from the building was out there, too.
Yeah, that's... Yeah, it was an event.
Yeah, it was.
Hey, that's what it's like when your morning show's really kicking ass. Anything's an event. But that was an event. That was exciting.
Wasn't Cato Kalin a big event, too?
Oh, that was a big event. Geez, yeah.
That helped the show.
That was the OJ trial. Yeah, that was a big deal. And when he came in, there were security people, like, grabbed him right off the plane, because the fear was some local media will find Cato Kalin, because the OJ trial was going on. He had testified. It wasn't over, though. So, you know, that was a monster get to get Cato Kalin. And they took him to a hotel and they locked him in the room. It was like, you can't get out. Wow. You're locked in. Wow. I mean, it was almost felt like that.
You would have thought he was at Trump's with art.
I know. He was so known to everyone then. But I mean, that trial was so huge, and we were so all over that trial. Mike and I would go home, and they're 3 hours behind, so we get home at 1 or 2 o'clock. They'd just be starting, and we'd watch, and we'd call each other, oh, my God, did you see that stupid witness? And Cato was, you know, that was a big, big deal. And so we had an event at the Royal Oak Music Theater, which I still love the Royal Oak Music Theater to this day. Yeah. What a great venue that is.
Love it.
We went in there with Cato, and we went at him. We knew that trial inside out. And he just was the worst guest. He wouldn't say anything. He would not. He must have been afraid OJ was going to take his head off because he would not criticize OJ. In that respect, it was really disappointing to me because I thought, you know, maybe we could make some news, get something out of him.
Do you have to pay him a lot of money to come in? Is that it?
I think.
Why would he do it if he didn't want to?
Oh,
really?
It was money. It was money. Absolutely money. He was. I think that was one of the first ones he did, if not the first. And I want to say they paid him $5,000 or something. So he had to say something.
Right.
And the funny thing was, because it was the Royal Oak Music Theater, we had a crowd that morning, and there were a lot of girls there. I mean, he was, I guess chicks thought he was hot. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, he was a nice enough guy.
Right. He was Mr. California boy, you know.
Yeah, and no one has done more with less than Cato Kaelin. Honestly.
That is true.
We went through his Wikipedia one day, and it was like, he was on this reality show, that reality show, this reality show, that reality show. I mean, it was just crazy how that guy so is. Funny. Everything he's done is related to that to this day. And that trial was amazing. And I heard you talking, because you and Meltdown.
Mm-hmm.
Meltdown hosted your episode,
right?
Which was really good. When you talked about the OJ verdict came in when you were on the air, I remember that extremely well because I called in.
Oh, yeah.
I did.
Yeah, and Trudy was on the air with me.
Trudy was there.
And Doug Llewellyn. And I still can't remember how Doug Llewellyn ended up.
You know what? That was a fluky thing where didn't we just call him and ask him to do commentary for us? And he did. We paid him.
Oh, okay. Because you guys were talking to him.
Yeah, we were talking to him, and he knew less about the trial than we did. But he was Doug Llewellyn from the People's Court, right. And that's all that mattered.
Exactly.
He had all the credibility in the world.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was but, yeah, I so remember calling in, and I was so pissed because I'd seen the verdict, and I had also seen the reaction,
mm-hmm.
which was, I mean, that was really one of the craziest days in the world.
No kidding.
To watch groups of people in offices or just out and about who happen to be looking at a TV somewhere, and you would hear this incredible, oh, you know, this horrified gasp of, you know, a white dominated office. And then you would see a lot of black people watching the same thing and cheering wildly.
Right. And so different.
Yeah. It was one of those things where I just didn't get it. You know, I get it now to some degree. And, you know, I suppose we all need to try to understand each other. But at the time, it was just stunning to me. I just thought, how could anyone think that's a good thing? But if you remember, some people didn't think he was guilty, which is really weird to me.
Right. It's hard to fathom right now.
It's very hard to fathom. He only dripped blood from the murder site to his house, to the bedroom, to the bathroom. I mean, really?
Coming up.
The one that I think really sticks out in my mind is Saved by the Bell.
Mm. Oh, Dustin Diamond.
Dustin Diamond. Yeah, Screech. Yep. Screech. For some reason, he thought that we would want to talk about an argument he had with a bank over a land contract, which is like, I don't even really understand land contracts in the first place. And he wanted to go on and on about it. He wanted us to call this mortgage broker to bitch him out or to listen to him expose this person for ripping him off. It was so bad. He was such a flaming asshole. And I think I called him an asshole at the end of the interview, and he hung up. And since then, how many interviews have we done since?
I think two.
Oh, yeah. With him?
Yeah.
And they get really awkward really fast.
He was an asshole in all of them.
Really?
Yes. And I would do another one tomorrow.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
101 minutes of non-stop rip rock. This is the history of WRIF, the podcast.
Party with the Riff all weekend long because it's Big Daddy's four-play weekend on 101 WRIF. Riff rocks, baby.
More with Drew Lane from Drew and Mike.
So, Drew, you guys did a ton of interviews, just so many interviews. Which ones really stand out as either the best or, like, just going off the rails?
Going off the rails is a great question.
Well, it's Commander Lovell.
Oh, yeah, Jim Lovell, the commander of Apollo 13?
13, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I had a running joke about sticking your hand out the window of the shuttle just to see how hot it was outside on reentry.
You just didn't think it was funny.
No, I asked him, and it didn't compute. He said nothing. There was like 5 seconds of dead air, and then we realized that he's too mathematical and scientific to even process that question.
Right, right.
But it was very awkward.
And he didn't get that it was a joke.
No, he did not. No, it was extremely awkward. But Frank Zappa's son was a terrible interview.
Yeah.
Dweezil.
Was it Dweezil?
Yes.
He's horrible.
He was. Yeah, he was bad.
He thought he was extremely funny, and he was not funny, and we were trying to sort of go along. It was just the worst, and I think we declared it the worst afterwards.
Tara Patrick was pretty bad.
Yeah, a porn star was angry because we didn't have her latest film.
Oh, jeez.
Well, they sent us the wrong information.
Oh, I see.
Yeah,
they sent us information from the previous film. Like, porn films are so different, you know, that to be talking about the previous one was, that was just like, what? Yeah. She's really that angry about it? I mean, I didn't realize how sensitive a porn star could be.
Well, she had developed a lot as an actress between the ones.
Yeah. It was a really good plot.
Right.
And then the one that I think really sticks out in my mind is Saved by the Bell.
Mm. Oh, Dustin Diamond.
Dustin Diamond. Yeah, yeah, Screech. Yeah. Yep. Screech, for some reason, he thought that we would want to talk about an argument he had with a bank over a land contract, which is like, I don't even really understand land contracts in the first place. And he wanted to go on and on about it. He wanted us to call this mortgage broker to bitch him out or to listen to him expose this person for ripping him off. It was so bad. And plus, he was an hour late because he got the time zone wrong.
Mm.
He thought we were in the Midwestern time zone or vice versa. I don't know what. But anyway, he was such a flaming asshole. And I think I called him an asshole at the end of the interview, and he hung up. And since then, how many interviews have we done since?
I think two.
Oh, yeah. With him?
Yeah.
And they get really awkward really fast.
He was an asshole in all of them.
Really?
Yes. And I would do another one tomorrow.
Right. And he'll be an asshole in the next one.
Funny that he'll keep doing them.
The funny part about doing interviews with him subsequently is that it's interesting to try to guess how long it will take him to realize he's talking to us. And something clicks in at about the 2.5 minute mark where all of a sudden he gets a little chilly.
Celebrity hangups is something that happened a lot and became a bit on the show.
Yeah.
The Regent City, may I help you?
Dr. Kissinger, please.
Thank you.
Thank you. That would be my room.
Oh, boy.
Hello?
Dr. Kissinger?
Yes?
Yes, this is Drew and Mike calling. We're on WRIF Radio in the States. How you doing?
Very good.
Good. Are you enjoying the Olympic Games?
Very much.
Very good.
Did you get to see the beach volleyball at all? Because we were hoping to get some comment from you on the beach volleyball gold medal.
No, I didn't see it.
Yeah. Oh, I thought you'd be out there on the beach because there were some pretty attractive women out there, Dr. Kissinger. Brother. It was quite a scene.
Well, no, I wasn't. So, thank you for calling.
You're pushing it. How was the meal there in Australia?
Meal.
You know, there's a tension as a listener to hear these things, you know?
Yeah, that is the fun part, I think, is being on the inside of it. And there is tension, but, you know, it's funny. After you've done that enough times, it's really opportunity in your head. And you know there is tension, though. And sometimes there is tension, but we international hotels we found were just the greatest places. Once we knew, you know, the Olympics are in Barcelona and Magic Johnson's there and so-and-so's there. And you go, yeah, we're calling for an interview with Magic Johnson. It's Drew and Mike on WRIF Radio. And they go, oh, okay. And the next thing you know, it's Magic on the phone or it's OJ on. We did get OJ in.
After the murder. Well, you got him before the murder. I might have that. And then after the murder, too, where he was pretending to do a Jamaican accent. Remember when he was hiding down in...
Hey, Dale!
Hello! But he was hiding down in Florida
when
he had the whole ecstasy satellite TV card thing.
But we got him...
It was absolutely him.
We got him at the Super Bowl. The Super Bowl was a site of many, many celebrity
hangouts. You would just guess that they're at that hotel and then call?
Well, our intelligence got pretty good over the years. Mark and Mike would dig in, and they would find out what hotel are they likely at, and then you'd find out the AL team, the AFC team was at this one, the NFC team was at this one, and then it was off to the races.
Got it.
And then eventually what we do is we would spoil it for any other show from any station that tried to call anyone, legitimately or illegitimately, and frequently...
Yeah.
Hello, Juice?
No.
Yeah.
Is Juice there?
Juice, Juice, what's going on, man?
Who's calling?
It's Drew and Mike.
That reminded me, the Super Bowl calls reminded me of one of my all-time favorite hotel calls.
Heads up.
Oh, boy.
John Madden.
Hello.
John?
Yeah.
Hey, it's Drew and Mike calling on WRIF Radio. How you doing this morning?
I'm still sleeping.
Hey. Oh, John. Oh, John. I'm sorry.
Just
can we
for a second.
Back? John?
John?
He's hitting the touchstones. John Madden is hitting the touchstones. Yeah. He is, isn't he?
I think he hit like redial a bunch of times.
Oh, maybe.
I love so picturing funny. Him going toot 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 toot.
But I think the next day we called him back again.
John.
Yeah.
Hey, it's Drew and Mike calling on WRIF Radio.
Yeah, I'm in a meeting right now, so I can't talk to you. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry, John. I think we might have woke you up the other day, and we apologize for that.
Okay.
We're sorry about that. We love you, John.
Thank you.
Congrats on the Hall of Fame thing, by the way.
Thank you very much.
And we'll look forward to hearing you on Sunday night.
Okay, great. Thanks a
Thanks,
lot.
John.
All right, John.
So great.
And we developed the skill, too, of mispronouncing people's names as a way of having them believe that, oh, they don't even know who this is, so it must be real.
Right,
and
right.
It worked sometimes. And then also, well, that's too bad because we got a package for them.
Well, and then the way you guys lead them on, like you're always just trying to get them to talk about something.
You play dumb and you're really friendly. It's hard to get rid of a dumb, friendly person.
I know. And the whole package thing was like, hey, look, I get paid by the hour. I don't know how damn they get their playbook or whatever the hell it is. You know, they'd be like, can you bring the package to the front desk? No, it has to be given directly to them. I'm not allowed to give it to anyone else. But, you know, if you don't care, I don't care. You know, and then eventually, every now and then, somebody puts you through and...
You know, what I love about the show is it feels like you're just listening to your funniest, goofiest friends, like you're just hanging out with them all the time. And you guys can just turn the most common everyday thing into something really, really funny. Mark, play that snot funny bit, because this is just a perfect example of just spontaneity. And really,
I'm not afraid
stuff.
Of them, though. I'm not allergic to any bee, so I'm not afraid of them.
Although, Drew, remember that beautiful kill I executed?
Yeah, Mike did. Killed him right into his briefcase.
Yeah. Oh, a big chunk of saliva threw off Drew. Oh, man, I saw that was the size of a bowling ball,
it came out of my nose.
That's unfortunate.
I still don't know where it is.
Yeah, it's on the floor, I think. Don't slip, Derek. It's big.
That's the second.
It's not that big. It's
like an oyster,
for God's sake.
No, it's just like, it looked like a little piece of rubber cement.
Somebody's going to slip and fall. Put prime tape around that booger. Ah, for God's sake.
You guys never had a problem laughing at yourself.
No.
Mike was always so helpful, just like when Drew had quite possibly almost fried the whole board at
Here's a letter someone wrote to Mitch.
Oh, nasty coffee spill. That's bad.
That's bad. Here. That's really bad.
Get over here.
Get Millward.
Yeah, Millward. This is a big one.
It's a disaster.
Yeah, that's the biggest disaster possibly ever. Get it into the board.
Yeah, boy.
Front end into the board. Did they ever caulk this board?
I'll play the CD.
All right.
Play the Mike the Deadbeat.
Oh, boy. Did they ever caulk the front of this board?
Mind you, he is just sitting there watching this all happen.
He's not helping at all.
Everybody else is running around trying to sop up all this coffee.
Oh, that was a big cup of coffee. You can hear the spill. You can hear the poof. Yeah. In fact, you guys slowed it down.
Did you and Mike ever get in a fight? Did you and Mike ever get in a fight over anything?
No, not really. Yeah, we disagreed about certain things. It might, you know, it could be something dumb like, are we going to do the Tiger game live? You know, are we going to leave in the middle of the show to go do it? Or we get down there, or where's he going to park? You know, or stupid, because he was real paranoid about stuff like that. But, it, you know, not really about little things. We really were pretty loosey-goosey. In fact, after 105.1 ended in 2015, and we started doing the podcast together, which was the whole idea, was to work together again and sort of rebuild the audience. I didn't even think we would ever turn into a business. But, you know, there was great excitement about that. And it was fun, you know, to get the show back together. But we started talking a lot and texting a lot. And it's like, all of a sudden nothing mattered.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we've had this great success and, you know, we're linked forever. I mean, you can't unlink us. And, and we both have so many of the same loves musically, and we love sending each other music. And the funny thing was, I could hear a song, maybe it'd be John Lennon or something, and go, oh my God, this is fantastic. You know, it's this alternate version or something. And I'm like, well, there's only one person who really appreciates this. I'll send it to Mike. And Mike would be like, oh my God, I love it. You know, 4 exclamation points. Always 4.
You used to talk to Mike a lot in the evenings and after you got home from work, right?
Yeah, we did. But honestly, the last few years, we talked a ton. And once you could text, once we started texting, it was like, you know, and we really had no business interest other than this podcast. Mm. We were texting all the time about little things and little funny things and this and the news. And, you know, did you see that? And a lot of music, too. We both loved rock and roll. He loved Eddie Van Halen. He loved the Beatles. He loved Hendrix. And so, you know, we had that very much in common. And honestly, over time, I realized that we had more in common because I always thought we were kind of yin and yang. Mm. But we really did have a lot of things in common. They're strange things, but they're very much in common. Among them, when we like something, he and I both just go full overboard, completely, you know, over
love
the top.
It, yeah.
You know, him with flying, me with the Beatles, you know, him with Van Halen, whatever it might be. So, but yeah, we generally speaking, we had a very serviceable relationship as far as the show went along. I mean, the show was one of those things that when the mics are on, and you know, it counts. And
what went through your mind the first time Mike introduced Butt Mike?
I think I thought we were going to be in trouble. That was probably the first thing that went through my mind. I just thought,
it's like rule number one in radio, don't fart in the microphone.
It just seemed like, but you know, we had talked about it a little bit, not a lot, but it's kind of like, well, what can someone do? I mean, is this really a crime? Is this an FCC crime? You know, is this, because the FCC had, the way the rules were written were so specifically ridiculous that it was like you couldn't say anything if you followed it to the letter of the law. And I think for some reason, because people played fart sound effects forever, it's like, so what's the difference between a real fart and what they're going to fine you for a real fart versus a sound effect?
So you guys were actually having a conversation about this before he ever did it the first time.
Well, I think we had more conversations after he did
it. Right. It seemed like it'd be more him. He'd just do it spontaneously. Do we have a butt mic?
Oh, I'm sure we have a few.
Oh, get that mic away from me. Get the mic away from me.
But Mike said I want a large fry and a chocolate malt also.
I vaguely remember, didn't you guys set up just a lavalier mic to his butt originally?
Yeah.
You know, as opposed, then it turned into him standing up and wiggling the microphone against his pants.
The mic rustling,
which worked a lot better than that lavalier mic.
Now with radio stations just being obsessed with researching everything and doing surveys, like did they actually like research butt mic to see if it was a hit or not?
I think it was so universally beloved they didn't need to do any research on it. That's funny though. You know, there's a lot of, I think in terms of having a successful morning show or show, I think there's, especially with rock and roll, you can never quite let that 17-year-old go.
Right.
Because there's something about you know what, guys, being 17, 16, 18 and busting your friend's balls and, you know, farting on somebody or whatever. I mean, that stuff just, it never stops being funny. And it also sort of, I think, reduces everything to, you know, can you really get that upset about something like that? Really?
It reminds me of a funny but real name, you know, calling people that have real names that are funny. Like, I don't know, would you remember any of them?
Oh, Harry Sachs.
Yeah, people like that. And I just remember one lady going, what are you, 13? Right. You go, I'm 37 if you must know, or whatever it was.
I had this really good friend of mine, and he was a really well-respected psychologist, and he had this lifetime, like, study, and his foundation was that all men, to a certain degree, don't mature past 14.
Really?
And that really makes a lot of sense, because if you see like an 80-year-old guy and a chick with big boobs walks by, he's instantly 14 years old. You know?
No, I mean, there's just it's inarguable. I don't think men ever stop appreciating attractive women. I don't think men ever stop laughing at farts.
Yep.
And Mike never got past those things, obviously, among others.
Was it surprising how many women love the show?
Yeah, it was a little bit. But, you know, I think that I don't think we gave women enough credit for having a sense of humor. And, you know, Trudy is a good example of that. Trudy laughed at a lot of things that you would not expect most women to laugh at. And actually, she has a saucy sense of humor.
Yeah.
She's got a
great laugh, too.
She does. But she really, and sometimes she does it off the air, and I'm like, God, Trudy, you should just let it all hang out on the air. But she says things like, almost like, oh, I can't believe I said that. And it's always something really funny, really cynical. But she always, she laughed at a lot of stuff that most women don't. But actually, a lot of women that do laugh at farts and do laugh at stuff like that. And I think we learned that when...
There's an example of that.
No American guy would ever, ever, ever...
Oh, wish. For crying out loud.
That was aimed right at me.
Yeah, its trajectory. Its trajectory was right towards your belly button.
She was sitting right next to him with that butt mic.
Trudy was around morning shows her entire career, which are very guy-dominated.
Uh-huh.
And so I think she appreciated a morning show that was actually funny. Because I know she was in some that she didn't think were that funny, and she had to sort of go along with it because, you know, you expect people in the show to just do that.
Yeah, how did she become introduced into the show?
Well, she was hired originally. She was with us from day one, and we didn't know Trudy, but Trudy was known to people in Great American. Mm-hmm. And when, Lynn quit. That's right. Lynn quit the day before we started.
Right.
So immediately there was a rush to find a female. And Trudy was living in Columbus,
that's right.
I believe, at the time. And she'd been there before with LVQ.
Now, isn't that where Osham came from, Columbus?
He came from Milwaukee.
Oh, yeah.
Actually. Yeah. He had Bob and Brian was the morning show there. And Bob and Brian, I mean, I'm happy for those guys because they didn't play any music. And so Greg knew how well that worked. If you could get to that point and do it well, that you could have a position in the market that no one else could have if you got there first. And Bob and Brian had done that, so thanks to those guys for making Osham know it could work.
Right.
And Howard Stern for making Podell know it could work.
Sure.
There really were not... I mean, how many shows in 1993 FM shows were doing all talk?
Right.
I mean, Brandmeier, Bob and Tom, Howard Stern...
Ron and Paul, maybe down in Miami, were they? Is that a little
Ron and Ron?
Oh, is it Ron and Ron?
Yeah, Ron and Ron. Yeah, they did. I think they were a talk show. I mean,
so when Trudy came in, you guys did they just say, "Hey, here's Trudy, here's your new news girl," or how did that work?
You know, they took her to Trump's.
Yeah, of course. What else? We listened to some tapes of some people, really quickly. It was like, oh, my God, we're doing a show in a city that we don't know. And, you know, Mike is helping us as best he can. Nick Demos was helping out. God rest his soul.
Yep.
Karen Trombley was with us. And so, you know, we're all trying to sort of pour this thing into the show. At the same time, it's like, oh, my God, we got to find a news person. So we're listening to some tapes. And Great American had Trudy. I think that was a Great American station she was on. So they knew her, and I think they knew that she was available, unhappy, you know, slash unhappy, whatever it was. And so they were very much behind her, and they said, you're going to like her. She's going to be just right. And she came in, and things were a little frosty at first because we didn't know each other.
Right.
But she became one of the gang pretty quickly. I'm not sure when she crossed the barrier. It might have been the toe-sucking day. Yeah. That was a huge deal. At that time, that was a huge deal. Having a listener come in and suck her toes.
Yeah. This is fetish, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was a fetish, yeah. And
you knew she could hang, though. You
know? Oh, yeah. No, she got her spurs that day for sure. She probably
I think she liked it. I don't know.
Yeah. She was laughing, actually. She really was amused by it.
Right.
And the guy, we had whipped cream. And I mean, that was very funny, actually. We used to have some audio of that. I don't know if we still do, but
I'll look for it.
Gosh, it'd be really funny.
Yeah, Mike Clark was just so absolutely entertained by that. I mean, he was watching, and he just couldn't believe it was happening.
And I'm sure his play-by-play was pretty awesome.
I think it was. Yeah, Mike could do play-by-play, too.
Coming up.
Mike and I had spent... first of all, Mike was so excited, being the Van Halen fan he was, and he loved David Lee Roth. And while Mike, I think, always liked anything Eddie Van Halen did, he loved the David Lee Roth era of Van Halen better. Although we interviewed Sammy, and I know he loved Sammy, he just loved Van Halen, period. And we got to interview Eddie, too.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music.
Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
There's no telling how long you were asleep in that salad.
I think it's possible that I was asleep in my salad for upwards of 20 minutes.
Here is Mike Staff and our special guest, Drew Lane.
How important is it to for your personality to mesh off the air as much as it is on the air? Like, is it possible to mesh on the air if you're not cool off the air?
I wouldn't think so, but I've just heard of so many shows where the two people hate each other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just can't stand each other and never speak until the mic is open.
That's weird.
I know, it is weird. But I think in many of those cases, like Steve Dahl and Gary Meyer, two guys who were so good together, mm-hmm. and that was a funny, funny, funny show. And you can listen to it, stuff from 88, 92, 91, 86, and go, wow, this is a really good show. Whereas a lot of shows you listen to and you go, God, that show sounds so cliche or so old, sticky or whatever. That show was really funny and it remains funny. And that was one of the nice things when we started the podcast. And specifically, this is not a nice thing, but when Mike died, people wanted to hear old bits. Mm-hmm. And so we did put together a whole, was it a Facebook Live? Did we put it on Facebook or?
Oh, God, I think we just released it as a podcast.
Yeah, we put out a couple of those. And I know the one had something like 150,000 listens that day.
Wow.
And the second one, I know it's still, because I get the scorecard of our downloads every day, and it has best ofs next to it, because we used to put out a best of on Saturday for the podcast, and one of them is best of Drew and Mike, and that has like 600,000 downloads, and it's still going up. So I'll notice, oh my God, it just clicked 601, you know, and
yeah.
That's an awful lot of downloads for a radio show that has not been around for 10 years for the most part.
Right.
Pretty amazing. But honestly, Dahl and Meyer, they had a couple of days where they bumped into each other when Steve was doing a remote, and he's like, oh, Gary's over there. And they're like, well, why don't you invite him over? And he came over. And it was really entertaining. Mm. But I just think they had that rhythm on the air. And I think there are shows where people at one time were great friends together or got along or made each other laugh. And then when the relationship soured, they still knew how to turn the mic and somehow get the job done. Yeah. And also that tension can work in ways you'd be surprised.
Right, right. Well, that's performers, though. It's time to perform. You turn it on.
Yes.
So we've talked a lot about how important the locality, like the show being local, is. And it is. It was one of the most important aspects of it, for sure. Did you guys ever get offered or think about going syndicated or going into other markets?
Yeah, we did. It wasn't something we really pursued, though, for a few reasons. One, Mike never wanted to leave. He just did not want to leave.
But couldn't you just do the show live and broadcast it on other stations?
You know what? We could have. And honestly, we probably should have. And we should have pursued that. And I think there were situations where Greater Media, maybe a Boston station, lost a show or something, and, hey, why don't you just pop us on there for a month or something? Or, you know, in Philadelphia where they had MMR. But we never really pushed it, and I think – I'm not really sure – I don't know. The thing about WRIF was it went so well, and it went so well beyond anyone's wildest dreams for Mike and for me, that every time we talked about – and there was one specific thing with when Howard Stern left –
You should tell that story. That's a great story.
Yeah.
But that did involve moving.
Yeah, that would have involved...
When Stern left the second time.
When Stern left to go to satellite radio.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And yep. They had to, you know, how are we going to replace this killer show that is killing it in so many different markets? And among other things, they were talking about, you know, with that one person and... Then at other times they were talking about, well, do this with these stations, this with these stations. Anyway, we were in a meeting with this muckety muck from CBS. I hate calling him a muckety muck because he's a really good guy. I just can't think of his name. He is truly a radio muckety muck, though.
That's a term of endearment.
And Mike Novak had talked to him, and Mike was naturally very interested as, you know, our representative. And Mike said, you know what? They want you guys to do Chicago, Cleveland, and Detroit. And it could spin into more than that. And so I was thinking about it. And the thing about it, I know Chicago very well. And Chicago, like Detroit, mm-hmm. I felt like, I don't know if you could just blow a show in from Detroit to Chicago and have success there. And the idea of failing miserably in Chicago without really giving a good shot was very unnerving to me being from there. And so I kind of felt like we would have to move there to have success in Chicago. You'd have to go, you'd have to beam it back to Detroit, beam it to Cleveland. And I my feeling was too, that Detroit will love the show. I think the show's established and we could do that. It was, I wasn't crazy about the idea, but if we were going to do it, I felt like the thing to do would be to do it live in Chicago. And then if that worked, I mean, if Chicago blew up, I mean, then who knows what else could happen. But we were older by then, and I say older, you know, I was 45, maybe 46. I don't know. I guess it seemed like the WRF thing was so, it just worked so well. It was like, who wants to fuck with this?
Right. Well, and you would have had to sacrifice a lot of bits that just aren't going to work anywhere else.
That's true. And also there were things locally that you couldn't talk about either, because you would lose the Chicago audience or the Cleveland audience. But we went to, the funny thing was, this guy was in town for, God, that was the All-Star game, wasn't it? So that would have been 2006.
Yep.
Is that when Stern left? I guess that was when Stern left.
Yeah, because he's been on satellite 15 years.
So. Yeah, okay, that all makes sense.
When that flies by.
Yeah. So, I know. So we had to meet with him, and my mom had come in for the All-Star game. So I said, hey, you want to go to the All-Star game? Oh, yeah, sure. So my mom was with me, and Mike said, you know what? He's just going to be here for the day. Just bring your mom to the interview. And so I did.
2005.
Was that when the All-Star game was?
Yep.
Okay. So my mom's at the interview with us, and my mom's like, oh, well, this is so nice, you know? And she's just being herself and really just asking any old question. Meanwhile, we're trying to talk about this. And at one point, I don't know if it was that interview or we had another conversation where he said, we have to find a national personality to do New York and to do Philadelphia. And I think they had a couple other markets in mind. They felt that Howard had become such a huge name that they had to have a celebrity. And so they said, everyone's called us about this job. You know, Ted Nugent, Whoopi Goldberg, I think, was one of the names. I was like, Whoopi Goldberg, really?
Wasn't David Lee Roth on that list?
That was who got the job.
Oh, yeah, he did. Yeah.
And so anyway, he's telling me that originally, I think their first choice was John Stewart.
Mm.
And John Stewart had unequivocally said, absolutely not, because he did 20. Was the show a half an hour he was doing on Comedy Central?
Yeah, it was the Daily
Show.
Yeah.
He was doing 22 minutes a day, and that was overwhelming to him. He could not imagine putting a four-hour show together that was fresh and live every day at that time of day. He just was like, absolutely not. And they had a couple other people they were interested in, and John Stewart would have been a good choice, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
I think he would have been good.
He'd be a perfect choice.
He would have been perfect.
But if he wanted to, and he didn't.
Right, he didn't.
Yeah, you've got to want it to do that kind of work.
So they were getting down to some other people. And he referenced a lot of people that had called about the job. I can't think of all the names, but it probably will come to me. Anyway, at one point he asked me about David Lee Roth. And David Lee Roth, because they were talking to him, and I didn't know this, but David Lee Roth had just been in studio with Mike and I.
Yep.
Just happened. I mean, what was it, weeks before that or something? It wasn't long.
It wasn't that long. I mean, it was very fresh in our mind.
Yeah, he came in with a band. And they played, what were they? They were playing Van Halen songs.
Panama, I remember them doing.
But they were sort of, they were reimagined.
It was like a Vegas type performance.
Yeah, it was odd.
Which makes sense.
Yeah.
It was very Dave.
Yeah.
But Mike and I had spent, first of all, Mike was so excited being a Van Halen fan. He was, and he loved David Lee Roth. And while Mike, I think, always liked anything Eddie Van Halen did, he loved the David Lee Roth era of Van Halen better. Although we interviewed Sammy, and I know he loved Sammy. He just loved Van Halen, period. Mostly Eddie. And we got to interview Eddie, too, and Sammy, which was really, I mean, Eddie was, I think we talked to Eddie for 45 minutes or something right after they split up. It was pretty wild. But David Lee Roth, Mike spent so much time. I mean, he had pages and pages of notes. He was so excited to talk to David Lee Roth. And I was, too, because I really grew into a Van Halen fan. I'm a bigger Van Halen fan than I ever was before I met Mike. And as time went on, it became bigger and bigger. So I had all kinds of things I wanted to ask David Lee Roth. And a few just, I thought, he's such a rambly guy. There's just a few things I really want to make sure we ask him. And he came in, and he started doing his yammering.
Yep.
The band was all set up, and his raps would sort of, you know, I think he would, like, point his finger, and the next thing you know, you'd hear a drum, and they'd go off into a song. And it was like, what is this? This is ridiculous. And the music sounded good, and he sounded good and all that, but we did ask questions. He never answered anything. He never answered one question. So when this guy asked me about David Lee Roth, I said, no way.
Yeah.
I said, he doesn't listen.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him, we just had him in studio. He's the worst listener I've ever been in the same room with, honestly. He just says what he ever's in his brain is going to be spit out. And I don't think whoever else is in the room makes any difference.
Right.
And I just don't. I think he's a bad listener, which equals bad radio host.
Yeah.
And by the time I had finished this, Mike Novak was kicking me under the table because I think he sensed that they were talking to David Lee Roth. Mm. And in fact, they did hire David Lee Roth. And in fact, I was right. Because it lasted 4 months.
Yeah, well,
and I think they guaranteed him a lot of money.
I'm surprised it lasted that long.
I know. No,
it was very hard to listen to.
Well, they thought that he was going to, you know, the celebrity, his Rolodex of rock star friends, and he'd make those calls, and it would be fantastic. And it's...
But he couldn't ask them questions about them. It's all about Dave.
Well, that's what I think, you know, that's a really good example of how people don't understand what makes a good radio show. I think they just thought, you know, it's simple, get this star, and he calls his friends, and you're off and running. And, you know, Ted Nugent, I think the feeling was the same way that, Ted comes in, he calls, because that was one of the first things at Riff that blew my mind was they said, Ted Nugent's coming in to do a week with you guys. I was like, really? Wow, how does that work? You won't have to do much.
They were right, huh?
And it's true, and they did, the main thing they asked me to do was to try to get him to talk about music. Because Ted loved talking about hunting, still does.
Yep.
He loved talking about Camp for Kids. I mean, he had a lot of great topics that connected really well with the audience. But the feeling was that when you get Ted talking about music, you're really bringing the whole tent in.
Yeah.
And when he does talk about music, I love what he has to say. It's fascinating.
No question.
Yeah, and he's a great – it doesn't matter what he's talking about. Ted Nugent is a great guest.
Yeah.
And the last time we had him on was on the podcast – was it maybe the same year as the shooting?
We've had him on twice.
Yeah, we have. That's right. Ted's a great guest. He's one of the best guests you can have.
Well, it's easy to prep for, too.
Oh, yeah. No work involved whatsoever. But one of the times we had him on the podcast, he had just called the school shooting in Florida, David Hogg.
Yeah, Parkland.
Parkland. Mm-hmm. He had called the Parkland kids soulless.
Oh, jeez.
And so he was very much, you know, trending on Twitter, and Ted Nugent's the worst person ever.
Oh,
and when we got the call, I think they weren't sure what we were going to say because I don't think Detroit Radio did one interview.
No.
Because everyone just said, no thanks, no thanks, no thanks, no thanks. And I said, you know what? I really don't care. Ted Nugent. He's always been great for us. He's always been nice to me personally. You know, I'm not going to just drop him like a brick because of this one thing. And we got him on, and he explained the whole thing, and he was his usual fabulous self. And some people were very angry that we had him on, but there are a lot of other people who absolutely loved it. And
just fine. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and we've had him on since then.
Yeah, give him a chance.
But yeah, having him on for a week, wow, that was really something. And well, watching Ted play Fred Bear in studio live.
Yeah, when he brings his guitar in, yep.
I was going to ask you, were you ever in when he did the morning thing with us? Because
yeah, I was running.
You were the bleep guy.
Yeah, I was a bleep guy. Yep. That was a thankless job in Ted's eyes, that's for sure.
Yeah, it was not only thankless. I believe he cursed you out.
He sure did.
He looked at you and was like, "You didn't clip that, did you?" And Mike could just be cowering in the next room.
Oh, like, I didn't know that. Wow.
I got some very specific instructions, man. Yeah. I was trying to, like, you know, be the best. I'd rather, like, err on the side of caution on that. But after he nailed me the next day, that was the first thing somebody told him, like, man, he'd been bleeped all morning. You know? First thing he said the next day. And I was like, okay, I wasn't so quick to bleep him. I didn't know what to do.
Tattletale factor is so huge when something like that happens. Can we take a quick break?
Sure.
I just got to run up and check something, and there should be a commercial here, of course, but why isn't there a commercial?
Perfect moment.
Does anyone want to be a sponsor of this History of WRIF? Shouldn't there be a sponsor, for God's sake? This has been great, Mike. I've enjoyed this a lot, I have to tell you.
Great.
I've listened to every episode, and Steve Costan is probably my favorite because I should talk to Steve more, but he's such an encyclopedia of rock and roll knowledge. Man. That is a fantastic episode. Jim and George were a really good episode,
so
too.
So great to get them together, back together again.
Was that the first time they've...
In a long time, yep.
No kidding.
Yep.
They were really good. I really enjoyed
that. They were super eager to do it. Everyone has been super excited to talk about Riff, you know?
No, I totally understand because Riff is, you know, even a year or two later, and people are like, oh my God, that fucking Riff, I can't believe you're not on there anymore. And I just could not summon up the anger. I just didn't feel that way. You know, maybe you feel angry at first or upset, but it was a long time to be at one place. And, you know, we were treated and compensated very well, and it was just such a positive thing. I just couldn't run around saying I was angry at them.
Well, in 22 years, most people in radio don't stay at the same radio station.
No, they don't.
Arthur P. is the anomaly.
Yeah, that is really 39 years. Wow. Yeah,
crazy.
Anyway, yeah, I'm going to take a quick break, okay, and we'll be back.
Next time.
And honestly, the song Jet Airliner was playing out of that as we're looking up at the TV screen and seeing a plane fly into a building in New York City. And was that the first plane or was that the second plane?
It was the first plane because the second plane was live. I was in the office and saw that's when the Today Show cut in and showed the first tower on fire. So that coming out of it, that's when you, I mean, I think the first things out of your mouth were, you know, this coming across, there is a plane has flown into the Trade Center.
More with Drew Lane from Drew and Mike.
Yeah, and it was...
And Plane Man took over, and...
Yeah, Mike was the perfect guy to have for that day.
And I believe you had just read a Newsweek article about Bin Laden.
Yeah.
The attack on the Kursk or the coal, whatever that sub was in Yemen.
So you were calling Bin Laden on it?
Think I said Bin Laden's name pretty early in the broadcast.
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Because listening back, it's funny when you listen back on it and now you know all you know and you go, shit, I got that wrong. I got that right, you know.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.